It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there aren't enough candidates to go around in the state legislature with many uncontested seats in November. Our guest says that's bad for state government, maybe bad for us.
First, Milwaukee is the fourth unhappiest city in the country, even more unhappy than recently bankrupt Detroit. That's according to a new report out by the U.S. National Bureau of Economic Research.
Those rankings are based on self-reported satisfaction of residents in cities. New York City ranked as the unhappiest city, followed by Pittsburgh, Louisville, then Milwaukee, with Detroit coming in at number 5.
And when you look at the map that goes along with the study, Wisconsin is a state is generally pretty happy. In fact, Milwaukee seems to be the only part of the state that actually ranks as unhappy.
This survey is self-reported. It's hard to tell exactly why things came out that way, so we want you to fill in the gaps. Why do you think Milwaukee ranks as one of the unhappiest cities in the country? What do you think it is about other cities in Wisconsin that point to happiness? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Here to talk about why Milwaukee is dissatisfied and maybe what it has to look forward to is Jabril Faraj. He's a Milwaukee-based writer and founder of MilwaukeeStories.org. Jabril, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So for MilwaukeeStories.org, what you do is you go around Milwaukee, you interview people that you meet, and in doing that, do you get a sense of dissatisfaction among Milwaukeeans?
A little bit. It's funny, when we get to talking about, you know, the people that we have in our city, there's definitely emotion away from dissatisfaction to hope, you know, and it, depending on the person you talk to, you know, a single person could really talk about both of those things. So they're not mutually exclusive, but you know, there are definitely some impressions of attitudes in this city, I would say, that, you know, have discouraged some people and probably have helped to contribute to what we're talking about today.
Okay, so you're saying impressions of attitudes. What kind of attitudes?
Well, you know, some of the people that I've talked to have described Milwaukee as a negative city. I think a lot of that is stemming from, a woman I talked to about last week, I think. You know, she says she's a machinist. She's black, white, and part Native American as well. And she talked about experiencing racism and sexism, you know, in the workplace and outside of it. And she says that, you know, that's not really exclusive to her, obviously, but, you know, she's seen those things affect everyone, and that she feels that in Milwaukee particularly, people very often will judge you based on what you look or talk like, regardless of your intelligence.
And so do you think in general, the people that you spoke with, they sort of give off a sense of unhappiness, or is it something that's sort of more subliminal? People go about their business, but maybe they're less happy than someone who's living in, you know, a different place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think people are wallowing in their unhappiness. I think it's very much a, you know, I live here and this is how life is. And maybe I'm not quite as happy as I would like to be, but there's not much I can do about it right now. You know, I think when we talk about, you know, the study in particular that we're talking about today, you know, I think it mentioned that while, you know, some people are will ignore that unhappiness or put up with it if they have, you know, higher wages, higher incomes, or lower housing costs and such. And it is true that Milwaukee is a relatively inexpensive place to live. But at the same time, I think, you know, the reason why we see people not just leaving the city is probably because a lot of the people who are primarily unhappy don't necessarily have the means to do that and change their situation.
Well, we'd love to hear from someone in Milwaukee. What do you think of this? Is Milwaukee an unhappy city? Number one was was New York. Milwaukee, number four in terms of self-reported unhappy people living in cities. And we're curious about what you think. Do you think this is, you know, rubbish? Or do you think there's something to Milwaukee having some sort of a cast as a negative city, an unhappy city? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And what about things that are positive? Do you hear any of that as you're going about your job collecting stories, Jabril?
Definitely. You know, I would say let's not cast Milwaukee as a horrible place. There are a lot of positives. I'm a lifelong Milwaukee resident myself, and there are good things going on here. There are big opportunities in terms of water technology for this city. That's something that's, you know, going to be big in the future. You know, in addition to that, we have a lot of great things going on in terms of entrepreneurship and technology and young people organizing. But for the most part, we see that happening in the downtown area. And when we really get to talking about the larger city, I think there's a large part of our city that a lot of people forget about. And that's, you know, Western Milwaukee and the South Side. And those areas have majority populations that are minorities. And the reality is that we haven't been able to develop enough jobs in the wake of some of the large manufacturing companies that we had that were stationed, you know, in the central city that provided jobs and employment. We just haven't been able to make up for that. And I think that's what you see, you know, affecting this issue. Mm-hmm. In particular, there was another gentleman that I did talk to who, you know, he was very, very much about this is my home. And he had talked about getting into the streets and fast money and such in his younger days. And he served some prison time, and now he's 40 years old, and he got his GED, and he's going back to get his associate's degree in business management.
Gotcha. I just want to jump in so we can get to some callers here who are now with us. We've got Scott joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Scott. What do you think?
Hello. Hi. Well, I think, you know, I'm a Milwaukeean for the last 23 years. I think that a lot of this stems from racial inequality and economic inequality. I think there is a large segment of the population that has been pretty much, I don't want to say downtrodden, but I want to say downtrodden. I think there are a number of people that I've run into that this is reality for them. And it's a problem. It's a problem. I think Milwaukee's a great city. And I think we have so much going for us compared to other cities. But I think that's really the key ingredient is that inequality.
All right. That's an interesting one. Scott, thank you so much for that. And let's go right on to Chris, who's going to weigh in from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I lived in Milwaukee for 30 years. I'll try and make this fast. And I owned a home there for 20. I have a bunch of friends who have put their blood and guts into houses there, and they're all reaching retirement age, and everybody is talking about bugging out. I think you're going to see that happening a lot. What I wanted to talk a little bit about, because your guest just covered a bunch of the things that I wrote down, the government is corrupt, and it's been corrupt for 60 years, especially the police department. And I don't know if the reports I've gotten from my friends is that they haven't fixed the problems with the police department. That's not my opinion. They've been killing people and stuff. And the other thing that happened is that during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the city never held the inner city landlords, who the people don't own their properties. They never held them to task to fix these properties up, and the housing in the inner city has gone to hell in a handbasket, basically. And then the third thing I wanted to say is that the media, for years and years and years, was just the Milwaukee Journal, the Milwaukee Sentinel, and they just basically kissed the butts of the status quo. never did anything, never did any investigative reporting about anything. And this has just been left to fester. And
okay.
Now they've
got... Gotcha, Chris. Thank you so much. We've got your 3 points in there. And before we go to another call, Jabril, do you want to respond to what Chris had to say?
Yeah, well, a lot of what she said I can't necessarily confirm or deny, but I want to definitely agree with Scott. You know, I think we could describe Milwaukee as a tale of two cities. It was, you know, recently said that Wisconsin is the worst place to raise a black child. And, you know, we know that that Milwaukee is the most segregated city in the country. And, you know, I think when Chris, our second caller, you know, was talking about the media and perception, I think that goes into that as well a lot, where some people are just hearing certain things about certain parts of the city. But really where that all, you know, where all these issues start is with jobs and education, and that's really what we need to start looking at.
And we're going to take one last call. We're going to go to Haley in Madison. Hi, Haley.
Hi.
What
I just want to say I moved to Madison this past fall from Milwaukee after living on the east side for 5 years, and I miss it every day. I loved Milwaukee. There's a great culture, a great park system, things like the Urban Ecology Center, and it was so much more affordable than Madison, which I really do miss.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Haley, thank you so much for joining us, and Jabril, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jabril Faraj, a Milwaukee-based writer and founder of MilwaukeeStories.org. We've been talking about a recent report showing that Milwaukee ranks as the fourth unhappiest city in the country.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, news guy Noah Ofshinsky brings us up to date on the top stories in Wisconsin news, including the dueling ads from Mary Burke and Scott Walker.
First, it is a big election year in Wisconsin. That race for governor is grabbing most of the attention, followed by campaigns for Congress and the Attorney General's office. But the state legislature is also up for grabs.
But in many districts, it's not up for grabs, and voters in November will see just a single name on the ballot as races go uncontested. Our next guest is worried about what that means for democracy in Wisconsin.
Todd Berry joins us in the studio. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He recently crunched those numbers on state legislative campaigns. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Well, let's check out the numbers. How many seats are going to be uncontested come November?
Yeah. Well, we have half of the state Senate up, so that's 17 seats. And all of the assembly, so that's 99. So we're talking about 116 potential contests. And right now, there are 40 of those, almost a third, that have absolutely no contest whatsoever. And after the primary, because the major Democrat or Republican candidate will have no major party opposition, that number will rise to 55, which is almost half the seats.
And you wrote something like this in your report. Basically, some people are going to be elected by virtue of filling out the papers.
That's right. Nomination papers were filed at the beginning of June, and that's when we sort of went through this count. And it's disconcerting because the total number of candidates has been dropping for several elections, and that total is one of the lower in the last decade or two.
Before we get to the why, let's get to the so what. What do we lose if there isn't more competition in these elections?
Well, you know, there's something called a representative democracy. and we elect people from constituencies, from districts, and usually this system works better when you have a little bit of discussion during the campaign so that the voters learn a little bit about the candidates, so that the candidates learn a little bit about what voters think. So the information flows both ways. If you don't have that, you have less informed, probably, legislative candidates in terms of being informed about their district. They certainly aren't going to feel as much pressure to be accountable to their constituents. And I think on the flip side, the public, because there isn't a campaign, is less likely to even realize that the legislature is out there. They're going to feel a sense of detachment. And that, you know, that is where the people are represented.
Well, let's now get into that why question. Something I think a lot of people would point to is there has been redistricting. So many of these districts are safe. Why bother to run on the other side if you know you're going to lose?
Yeah. Well, I think there's some truth to that, but I think there's a lot of other things going on as well. One thing I would point out is that we had redistricting in 2012, too. And there were almost 300 candidates running for the legislature. And this year, there are about 50 fewer. So it can't be all redistricting, I'd say. And the other thing that's interesting is that of the 55 seats that are going to have no real competition in November, they're almost split evenly between the parties. And I think one of the things about redistricting that both parties like is it tends to make more incumbents of both parties safe. That's exactly what's happened with congressional districts in Wisconsin. The Republicans and the Democrats, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, traded a few voters and made everybody happier.
Well, another explanation for not as many people running comes from William on Facebook, who writes, who can afford it without making deals with dubious interests? Campaigns are expensive. You got to sell your soul a little bit to run?
Yeah, there is truth to that. It has become more expensive over the years, particularly in more contested districts where outside groups, interests, whatever, from other parts of the state, from other parts of the country, will get involved. And particularly in districts that are served by television markets, those can get quite expensive. But I think there's other things. I have for a number of years helped teach a community leadership program in the Madison area. And I have from time to time asked younger people, these are people in their late 20s, 30s, younger professionals in particular, people who are interested in their community, why they don't want to run for higher office. And they're very clear. They don't want to put their neck out there and have it chopped off by just the sheer nastiness of campaigns. They don't want to put their families at that kind of discomfort.
There's always been some nastiness in American politics, at least at the national level. Do you think it is nastier now? You've been watching politics for a while.
I think it has become more combative in the last couple decades, just as a reflection of American politics generally. The electorate is more polarized. The parties are much more polarized. And as a result, there isn't as much, if you will, cross-pollinization across the ideological divide. And it's easier to sort of not trust, dislike, even hate the other side.
Well, I wonder about 2012. That was a higher number you mentioned. I wonder, is that some after effect of Act 10 and the protests and the recalls, and people were fired up? Some people were maybe more fired up to get out there and run, and that's waned maybe?
Well, that's possible, but remember the recall election had already been held, and so some of that emotion may have been dissipated by the recall. It also was a presidential year, and I think there is just generally more public awareness of presidential elections and therefore of elections generally.
How about the political parties? It's often viewed as their job to recruit candidates to run, even in districts where they're going to lose, to have somebody carry the banner and maybe help out with that statewide race.
Right.
Are they dropping the ball?
Well, yes, in a sense. I mean, if you go back into the 60s, the parties were volunteer, citizen-based parties, and the people that were elected to head those parties really made it a goal to fill the ticket, you know, from county offices and on up. And now that duty has pretty much fallen to the legislative leadership, and they make very strategic decisions. They don't recruit to fill the slate. They only recruit where they want to put their money and time in hopes of gaining an advantage that they didn't have in the prior election. So, in a sense, the strategic behavior is actually depressing numbers of candidates.
Hmm. We're talking to Todd Barry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He is worried about the large number of uncontested races that are going to show up in this year's November elections for the state legislature.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that this is a problem? Why do you think so many seats go uncontested? And what needs to change to get people to run? Would you ever consider running for the state legislature? Or maybe have you run? What were the pros and cons? Let us know at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue this conversation coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Todd Barry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He says too few people are running for the state legislature, with a number of seats left uncontested in November.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Why do you think people aren't putting themselves out there to run for the state legislature? Why do you think there are a lot of uncontested races? Have you ever run? Would you run for the state legislature? Why or why not? What's stopping you? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page. Well, Todd, let's get into another sticking point. We're just talking about during the news, actually. It's a full-time gig to get onto the state legislature. Is that a hurdle, an obstacle for people to get into it?
Well, I think it's part of the problem, both for running and perhaps for the product that is produced. The National Conference of State Legislatures classifies legislatures as, you know, citizen, part-time, full-time professional. And Wisconsin is in that small group of about 10 to 11 states that is classified as full-time and professional. And incidentally, one of the smallest states to have such a legislature. You know, some of the other ones you'd expect, California, New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, large states. What I find somewhat amusing about that, and I watch state budgets in other states, is if you want to find states that can't pass budgets on time and sort of sink into fiscal dysfunction, those are the same states.
And is there something about being in a full-time legislature that maybe makes you more disconnected from your constituents, from daily life?
I think so. I mean, the old model, if you go back before the 70s particularly, you would see sort of this kind of profile. There'd be somebody who was farming, and maybe they were on a town board and they were in the state senate, or you'd see somebody on a school board maybe who owned a small insurance business and was in the assembly. So they had their feet planted in lots of different worlds, and it put them, I think, more in touch on a daily basis with a lot of different people. I think the other thing the full-time legislature does is that it changes the internal dynamics of the place and really makes the party leaders very powerful. Because if it's your full-time job and you want to keep that job, you want your bills to move, you want to be on the committees that you're interested in, you want to chair a committee, and the legislative leaders control all that. And I think what we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is both sides of the aisle have punished folks that weren't quite towing the line to the point where they ended up running as independents and winning, by the way. So I know the argument is made that the legislature or the state government is more competitive now or more complex now, and you need a full-time legislature. But, you know, on the other hand, when did we do university merger? Perhaps one of the biggest things in the last 50 years with a part-time legislature. We managed to build one of a fine school finance system with a part-time legislature. We did the biggest reorganization of state government with a part-time legislature. So I'm not convinced that necessarily you need a full-time body. And that's particularly true now with all the technology. You wouldn't probably even have to have a legislature meeting in Madison because you could do it all by distance.
So less is more.
Yeah.
Well, Ray in Heartland called, couldn't stay on the line. His question about why we don't have more competitive legislative races, is it because of two-party primaries or that we only have primaries for the Republicans and the Democrats?
I think he's on to something. Both Republicans and Democrats, if you look at state statutes, have put things in election law that tend to favor the major parties and tend to make it a little bit harder for independents or third, fourth party people to run. So I do think he's on to something. The other thing is the way we have structured party primaries is, of course, the turnout is very low in those races. So on the Republican side, they run to the right to appeal to the core voter. And on the Democratic side, they tend to run to the left to appeal to the core voter. And just not meaning to name names, but you can see that in the Madison area and in the Waukesha County area on both sides of the aisle. I think some other states have found a better way to do it if you're trying to get competition. And that is they have what's called a blanket primary. Washington State, California just recently, Louisiana. You just throw all the candidates in a hat. They all run in the primary, and the top two vote-getters go to the general election regardless of party. That means you're going to much more be likely to have a general election contest.
Another thing I wonder about is, and you've kind of alluded to this a little, are we just so cynical and not willing to believe that we can make a difference that we're not we're not going out and running for office?
Well, and I think it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy because the way we have structured things, it is hard to have impact if you're at all free thinking or independent because, again, the party leadership tends on both sides of the aisle tends to call the shots. The thing is, if you have enough people running who want to rock the boat a little bit, then the whole fruit basket turns upside down. And you have seen that in some other states where renegades on both sides of the aisle have gotten together and elected a speaker other than the one that the majority party wanted.
We've got a caller. We've got Ben in Turtle Lake now. Ben, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. I was wondering if you think that the media has anything to do with people deciding not to run. You know, if you run and your opinions are contrary to the major parties, you know, there's a lot of people in the state of Wisconsin right now that are thinking that the people are the people with the power rather than the parties. But if you go and say you're going to run as a candidate and that's going to be your platform, you can't even get a local newspaper to run your story about, you know, they're all talking about, well, that would be a campaign ad. We can't interview you. You're not a part of the major party. Do you think that's a part of the reason people don't run?
Well, I can only say this, and that is when you look at statewide races for governor and attorney general and so forth, and you do have third-party candidates running in some of those, they gripe that they can't get access to voters because they're shut out of debates, including, I might add, public television debates.
Thanks a lot for the call, Ben. Now, Todd, I got to say, this is a little off the beaten path for you, this whole topic. You usually do numbers, taxes, budgets, that sort of thing. Why did you decide to pursue this issue? What got you worked up about it?
Well, it's something I've been interested in for a long time. But, you know, the core mission of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, if you go back to the 30s when we were founded, is really about civic education mm-hmm. and civic participation. And there is nothing more fundamental to all this than voters being active and informed and being candidates and having real discussion of issues. You know, we do what we can, for instance, in high schools. We publish the state's only textbook on state and local government. But, you know, how do we speak to adults? And I think this is an issue where you can say to adults, here's a little problem, folks. Maybe you can help do something about it.
We heard from a guest yesterday who made the case that we need to make civic participation more fun. He had ideas on how to do that. But, Todd, can you make the case that maybe fun isn't the right word, but that it is enjoyable to participate in public meetings, to run for office, to represent people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be. And particularly, I think you see a lot of people that want to run for, you know, a county board or a local city council. Generally, the atmosphere is part-time. It's generally fairly polite and civil. And they feel they can contribute something without having their, you know, family run through the grinder. It does seem that the tone of campaigns has become such that it really discourages people from wanting to run for the right reasons.
We'll leave it there for now. Todd, thanks for joining us
again. Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
That's Todd Berry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, talking about his report on a shortage of candidates for Wisconsin's legislature. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Kurt Vonnegut said, "In the water, I am beautiful." We'll find out why humans might be hardwired to love water.
First, news guy Noah Ovshinsky joins us for a weekly look at the big stories going on here in Wisconsin. Hey, Noah.
Good afternoon, Rob. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. Well, a lot of big news in the state this week. Let's start a big new poll, the poll a lot of people look to, the Marquette poll.
Right. So this latest poll, in a word, well, in a few words, it's a very tight race.
For governor.
The governor's race is very tight, and this latest poll certainly confirmed that. The survey showed that Governor Walker was leading Mary Burke by 1 percentage point among registered voters, but Mary Burke ahead of Governor Walker by 1 point among likely voters. So basically, a dead heat.
A dead heat, yeah. There's no poll that's not in the margin of error.
Both results were in the margin of error.
Until election day, pretty
exactly.
much. There's been a lot of action this week on the governor's race front in terms of advertising.
Right. And I think, you know, these numbers that we just talked about, the fact that this race is incredibly close, it goes some way in explaining really the latest theme in the race, which certainly this week has been Mary Burke's experience while she was an executive at Trek. The Walker campaign released what has become quite a controversial ad that criticizes her for benefiting from Trek's decision to outsource jobs.
This is not a typical Republican attack point.
No, it's a bit unusual for a business-friendly candidate like Governor Walker to criticize an opponent for outsourcing. It's really something out of the Democratic playbook, frankly. And indeed, the strategy has been criticized in conservative circles.
Yeah, some examples. Where has he gotten attention from?
Right. So in the opinion page of the Wall Street Journal earlier this week, an assistant editor wrote, quote, "We normally associate criticism of outsourcing with Democrats, but Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is a reminder that Republicans aren't above playing the Benedict Arnold CEO card themselves to fan populist furies."
And what have we unquote. Heard? What have we heard from the governor and his campaign in response to this criticism?
So the governor defended the ad. You know, he notes that nobody has really disputed the facts contained in the ads. And he says it's fair game to criticize Burke for what he sees as her hypocritical stance on some issues. And when he says that, he means, you know, here is a candidate who has financially benefited from a company that's outsourced, but at the same time is advocating an increase in the minimum wage.
And we've seen response ads from Mary Burke and a print ad from the company involved, Trek, disputing, I think, some of the facts in the ad. So this thing keeps having ripples. Now, this is a difficult case sometimes for a candidate with a lot of political career in their background against an outsider like Ron Johnson, a business person, or a Mary Burke, who doesn't have a lot of a political record to attack.
Right, exactly. You know, Mary Burke doesn't have much of a record. I mean, she's basically a newcomer to politics. I mean, she was involved in the Doyle administration. She was in the Commerce Secretary. She was the Commerce Secretary for a while. But basically, as an elected position, she's a newcomer. So, you know, Walker is somewhat limited in the lines of attack that he has simply because she doesn't have that record. And, you know, this attack of her business experience, this effort in part is to, you know, really dampen the enthusiasm among the Democratic base.
Yeah, we had a political scientist, Charlie Jacobs, on the other day, and he said this is not an ad probably that's going to get more people to vote for Scott Walker, but maybe it might persuade some people on the fence, maybe on the left,
right,
to not vote.
It's going to keep the Democrats at home on Election Day, you know. And I mean, make no mistake, Rob, this election is going to be all about turnout, turnout, turnout. And if Governor Walker thinks he can keep Democrats at home and get independents to either vote for him or keep them at home with a certain strategy, he's going to do it.
Now, these ads, the initial one and the counter salvos, have people talking about these ads?
Of course. I mean, certainly in the media, we're talking about them. And so there is this sort of multiplier effect that these ads can sometimes have, in addition to the, you know, when they actually air on TV and radio. You know, this issue of Mary Burke benefiting from Trek outsourcing, you know, it is sucking up a lot of oxygen this week, you know, and it means the candidates aren't talking really about some of the pressing issues that are facing the state and their fundamental policy differences. You know, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if and when those issues actually come to the forefront.
Well, here's one of them that might. Jobs has obviously been a big part of the last couple of campaigns here. Some new unemployment numbers out in the state. People who work for a living are obviously watching that, and the candidates are watching it, too.
Right. So, of course, I mean, you and I have talked on the air before during the show, you know, that jobs are going to be, you know, certainly probably the biggest issue in this campaign, except, of course, when you're talking about Mary Burke's experience at Trek. Mm-hmm. Unemployment increased in all of state's 32 largest cities in June. Racine had the highest unemployment rate of any city. That was at about 10.4%. And unemployment rates, if you break it down, went up in 61 of 72 counties, with Menominee County having the highest rate at 17.8%.
Overall, what was the unemployment rate in the state?
Right. So although unemployment went up in the largest cities, went up in most counties, overall, though, the unemployment rate remained unchanged in June compared to May at 5.7%.
So because statistics or something?
Exactly. how can higher unemployment in the state's largest cities and most of the counties translate to an unchanged rate? Well, some counties are doing much, much better than others. So these increases aren't enough to nudge that overall number upward.
So politically here, I guess each side could probably take something and run with it here. The Burke campaign could point toward, hey, we're not creating jobs at a high rate. You're not going to hit that $250,000 job pledge that candidate Scott Walker had made. On the other hand, our unemployment rate, as I understand it, is better than the national average.
Right. Even at the rate of 5.7%, it remains lower than the national average of 6.1%. And certainly Governor Walker and those in his administration will point to that as evidence that the economy is improving under his stewardship.
Okay, and I'm sure we'll be checking in on every bit of job report coming in between now
every
and November.
Every single one.
Yeah. Though it seems like we don't, it used for a while there, that monthly report everybody was jumping on, even though everybody knew that it wasn't all that reliable. And now we're looking at that more reliable quarterly report usually.
Yeah, exactly. And that comes from the Labor Department. And we will get one more set of those, what we call the gold standard numbers. We'll probably get one more set of those numbers before the election. And so there will be, I can't tell you exactly when those numbers will be released, but you can bet when they are, it will, I think, have an effect on the race.
There'll be ads about it before the ink is dry.
Exactly.
So we've been watching the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, I should say. They've come out with a lot of stuff, a lot of news-making decisions this week, no exception.
Right. So two federal courts actually this week came down with conflicting rulings this week dealing with the ever controversial Affordable Care Act. And these rulings are very relevant to Wisconsin, and I'll explain in just a second. First, the D.C. Circuit ruled in a split decision that the Affordable Care Act prohibits the feds from providing subsidies to those who purchase their insurance on the federally run exchange. Now, on the same day, the Fourth Circuit in Virginia ruled that the subsidies can be given to everybody. And, you know, why are these subsidies a key part of the ACA so important? Well, they make the insurance for millions of folks in the United States affordable.
Right. This is viewed as a key thing. We're requiring you to get this insurance. If you can't quite afford it, here's the subsidies to help you pay for it. Where does Wisconsin fit into this picture?
Right. So this is very relevant for us because Wisconsin is one of the roughly 35 or so states that turn to the federal government for its exchange. So the long-term viability of this current setup, at least in the state, is in question because at least one court has said that folks who are getting their insurance under that federal exchange can't get the subsidies.
Now, I cheated a little bit in setting this up and foreshadowed a little bit. I said Supreme Court.
Right.
Ultimately, this is probably where it's going to end up.
You know, I'm not a betting man, but I would say that it's highly likely that this case will end up in the Supreme Court. You know, if these subsidies do go away, I mean, if the Supreme Court sides with the court that was against the ACA, you know, it will present a dilemma for the governor and state lawmakers. You know, they may, and I emphasize the word may, you know, be put in a position where they will have to decide whether to create a state exchange in order to continue to get those subsidies to people who bought the insurance through the Affordable Care Act. And as you might remember, Governor Walker was not a fan of this whole idea of a state exchange. That's why he depended on the federal exchange to help bring the ACA to the state.
And this comes amid a background of some criticism, including from Senator Tammy Baldwin, who was on the show about a week and a half ago, again, criticizing Governor Walker for not taking federal Medicaid money to help expand Badger Care. So these rulings are out east, but there's a lot of ripple effect here in Wisconsin, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, again, because we're one of those states that did decide to go with the federal marketplace. If we were a state that created our own marketplace, this particular court battle, you know, wouldn't necessarily be a major issue for us specifically, although, you know, this issue of subsidies, I mean, that's some of the financial grease that keeps the Affordable Care Act, you know, solvent. You know, it keeps it paying for the insurance for the folks who buy that insurance. It keeps it affordable. So, you know, if it were thrown out, not only would it really affect Wisconsinites, but it would affect really everybody across the country.
Bringing things full circle, is this an issue that you think might be fodder for campaign ads in the race for governor in the next couple of months?
Frankly, I would have thought so. By this point, mm-hmm. We haven't seen them yet. You know, we'll see. It's going to be a long few months between now and November.
All right. Now I'm going to surprise you here. 30th anniversary of the release of the movie Purple Rain. Do you have a favorite Prince song from Purple Rain?
From Purple Rain?
On the spot here, I know.
No.
No?
Yeah, although my favorite Prince song is, I think it's called Seven.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. That is a Prince song.
I think that's my favorite Prince song, although I don't think it was in the movie.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, Noah, thanks for joining us. That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. He's our news guy. He joins us each week at this time.